I really love the Book of Kings. There is so much here for us to see. So much of what God has taught us in the Torah is now at work in 1 Kings. And we're most of the way through the description of that first temple. And it's ornate and it's varied, fabulously expensive furnishings. And we're going to finish that discussion this evening. And then before we study the all-important consecration of Solomon's temple that appears in 1 Kings chapter 8, we're going to spend the rest of our time this evening following the saga of the first temple through almost four centuries of Israelite history until it is finally destroyed at the hands of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the saga of the temple is quite instructive because it essentially gives us an overview of the several kings of Israel and Judah. And what we will see is that were some pretty good ones and some really wicked ones. And last week, we ended when we were talking about the so-called molten sea, which was a huge pot of water that held about 12,000 gallons of Maim Chaim, living water. Living water was not water that had been ritually blessed. It was merely water from a moving source, like a river or an artesian spring. It was what the priests and not any other who used the water from the sea could use for primarily for washing their hands and for their feet. The purpose of washing was for sanctification, for purification. By means of washing hands and feet, which represented the extremities, by the way, of the body, these priests were demonstrating their complete devotion, the complete devotion of their entire bodies to the Lord, and especially to the ritual services that they were about to perform on half of all the people of Israel. It is from this ritual washing that the priests did that the sages eventually, well before Jesus' day, made it a tradition that all Jews should do a ritual hand washing before they eat food and before they pray, as a matter of fact. Now, we should not leave this subject of the molten sea without noting that in Ezekiel's temple of a future time during the millennial period, we're told there will be no molten sea. And while Christ is reigning, there will be rituals performed at the temple. What we see is that much like what happens after heaven and earth passed away and all is made new after the end of the thousand-year reign of Messiah, and certain elements of temple worship that at an earlier time were earthly symbols of heavenly things have now been replaced by the heavenly things themselves. Thus, Ezekiel 47 verse 1 tells us in his divine vision for the millennial temple, "Then he brought me back to the entrance of the house," meaning the house of God, "and I saw water flowing eastward from under the threshold of the house," the temple, "for the house faced east. The water flowed down from under the right side of the house, south of the altar." So during the millennial kingdom period, we will have living water flowing from under the temple itself with God as its source. This never-ending source of Maim Chaim, living water, which will be used for sanctification, means there is no longer any need to gather the living water through pipes and then placed into this great pot called the molten sea. Now, we find a parallel situation in the new earth at the end of the millennium when there is no temple, but instead we're told God is the temple. Revelation 21:1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the old heaven and the old earth had passed away, and the sea was no longer there. That's one we've heard many, many times. And the sea was no longer there. And by the way, the idea that the sea is no longer there, although the usual interpretation of this, the term the sea is referring to like our oceans, I think it's probably not referring to the oceans at all, but rather the molten sea. That great pot of water that was one time central to priestly ritual. What we need to notice is that just as the entry into the millennial kingdom began a series of changes to move us closer and closer to that full spiritual reality of God's principles, and then further and further away from the physical objects of ritual that were merely shadows and patterns of God's divine principles. So then, after the millennium, in the new earth, we've come full circle. Not only is there no longer a sea, which I'm quite sure means the molten sea, there isn't even a physical temple. Revelation 21, 21 through 27 says this: the 12 city gates were 12 pearls, with each gate made of a single pearl. The city's main streets were pure gold, transparent as glass. I saw no temple in the city, for Adonai, God of heaven's armies, is its temple, as is the Lamb. The city has no need for the sun or the moon to shine on it, because God's Shekinah, God's glory, gives it light, and its lamp is the Lamb. The nations will walk by its light. The kings on the earth will bring their splendor into it. Its gates will never close. They stay open all day because night will not exist there. And the honor and the splendor of the nations will be brought into it. Nothing impure may enter it, nor anyone who does shameful things or lies. The only ones who may enter are those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Thus, not only is there no physical temple needed, because God, who is spirit, is the temple, there's no sun or moon. Because we don't need physical light waves any longer. We don't need physical light because our physical eyes that require physical light waves to operate have been exchanged for bodies and eyes that now completely are perfected. They're spiritual in substance and nature. So instead of the light emitted from the sun and the moon, we're going to bask in the Lord's spiritual illumination for all eternity. This sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Thus, we see the progressive revelation of the temple that originally began in heaven as a spiritual ideal. In time, it became a physical object built by the hands of men, beginning with Moses in the wilderness tabernacle. Finally, at the time of the new earth, it completes a full circle as it returns to being of spiritual substance, in which God himself is that temple. And this is why, as believers, we need to study the temple from beginning to end in all of its various stages, because its journey reveals a divine pattern. Let's get to the next objects used in temple service by reading the remainder now of 1 Kings chapter 7. 1 Kings chapter 7, we're going to start at verse 27, which is on page 376 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. So we're going to start at 1 Kings 7, verse 27. He made 10 bronze trolleys, each one 7 feet long, 7 feet wide, and 5 1/4 feet high. They were designed with panels that were set between the corner posts, and on the panels between the corner posts were lions, oxen, and cherubim. The corner posts above were similarly designed. Below the lions and oxen were wreaths of hammered work. Every trolley had 4 bronze wheels and bronze axles, and its 4 legs each had cast supports, which were under the basin with wreaths next to each. The opening of the stand into which the basin was inserted was 18 inches high. The stand was round, resembling a pedestal, and it was 2.5 feet in diameter. On the stand were carvings, and the outside was square, not round. The 4 wheels were under the panels, and the axles for the wheels were attached to the trolleys, and each wheel was 2.5 feet in diameter. The wheels were made like chariot wheels. Their axles, rims, spokes, and hubs were all cast metal. There were 4 supports at the 4 corners of each trolley. The supports were attached to the trolley itself. In the top of the trolley was a circular support, 10.5 inches high, and the trolley's corner posts and panels were attached to its top. And on the sides of the panels and on its corners, he carved cherubim, lions, and palm trees, according to the amount of space each required, with wreaths surrounding. According to this design, he made the 10 trolleys. All of them were cast from a single mold so that they had the same size and shape. He made 10 bronze basins. Each basin's capacity was 220 gallons. And had a diameter of 7 feet. There was a basin for each of the 10 trolleys, and he arranged 5 of the trolleys on the right side of the house, 5 of them on the left. The sea he placed on the right side of the house towards the southeast. Hiram made the ash pots, the shovels, and the sprinkling basins. With that, Hiram completed all the work he had done for King Shlomo, Solomon, and the house of Adonai, the 2 columns, the 2 moldings of the capitals on top of the columns, the 2 nettings covering the 2 moldings of the capitals atop the columns, the 400 pomegranates for the 2 nettings, 2 rows of pomegranates for each netting to cover the 2 moldings of the capitals atop the columns, the 10 trolleys, the 10 basins on the trolleys, the 1 sea, the 12 oxen under the sea, the ash pots, the shovels, and the sprinkling basins. All of these articles that Hiram made for King Shlomo in the house of Adonai were of burnished bronze. The king cast them in the plain of the Yarden, the Jordan, in the clay ground between Sukkot and Tzartan. Shlomo did not weigh any of these objects because there were so many of them. Thus, the total weight of the bronze couldn't be determined. Now, Solomon made all the objects that were inside the house of Adonai, the gold altar, the table of gold on which the showbread was displayed, the menorahs, 5 on the right, 5 on the left in front of the sanctuary, of pure gold, the flowers, lamps, and tongs, gold, the cups, snippers, basins, incense pans, and fire pans of pure gold, the hinges of gold, both those for the doors of the inner house, that especially holy place, and those for the doors of the house, that is, of the temple. Thus all the work that King Shlomo did in the house of Adonai was finished. And after this, Shlomo brought in the gifts which David his father had dedicated, the silver, the gold, and the utensils, and put them in the treasuries of the house of Adonai. Ten laver stands made of bronze were built by Hiram, that skilled craftsman, so that several substantial-sized pots of living water were mobile, so they could be moved around that inner courtyard of the temple. They generally consisted of 2 parts, the lower part with the wheels, called the trolley, or mekonah in Hebrew, that really means base, and the upper part was called the basin or the laver, kior, in Hebrew. But in Western thinking, a base with wheels we call a trolley. And so that's the way it usually appears in English Bibles, just like it does in the complete Jewish Bible. Now these trolleys and the big pot sitting on them were very ornate. Once again, they were decorated with cherubim. Lions and oxen were included in the design along with palm trees. And these trolleys were large. However, there is disagreement over whether the quoted measurement of 4 cubits, around 7 feet, in the scripture passage is referring to the diameter of the water basin or its height. The complete Jewish Bible, pardon me, makes it the diameter, which is possible, since it is the same as the width and the length of the trolley, meaning it would be very stable when it was moved around. However, most Jewish sources say that the 4 cubits was the height of the basin, not its diameter. Yet if you put a 4 cubit high water laver on top of a 3 cubit high rolling platform, that's about 5.5 feet, that means that the rim of that water laver was somewhere around 11 or 12 feet off the ground. No priest could ever reach that without a ladder. So my opinion is that the water basin was rather large in diameter, 7 feet, but also kind of shallow, not terribly tall. That would allow for the priest to reach up and dip into it. Maybe they need some kind of a short footstool, something like that. Now, these rolling lavers of living water were moved all around the courtyard so that the meat from the slaughtered animals could be ritually washed with water. Note that these pots of water were not used for ritual washing of priests' hands or feet like the water was from the molten sea. There were so many people coming with their sacrifices at any given moment that they had to spread out. They had to make the use of the entire temple courtyard area. That was the reason for the 10 rolling lavers, so they could be repositioned as they were needed. Now, we're told that these held around 220 gallons of water, probably a little bit more than that, actually. And when they weren't in use, they were located neatly set in 2 rows of 5 in front of the temple entrance. 5 lavers on one side of the entry door, 5 on the other. Some of these objects were made in the Jordan River Valley between an area called Zartan and Sukkot. Other objects were made, no doubt, in the Timna region, inland of the Dead Sea. As a matter of fact, if you're going on the tour, you'll visit this area. Now, which was made exactly where is difficult to know, but it's hard to imagine these dense metal objects were made on the eastern side of the Jordan River, because then they'd have to somehow be transported across. Now, beginning with verse 49, the subject changes. From these large objects that were cast in bronze by Hiram to the more important sacred and decorative objects that were made with gold, some of them with silver. The verse begins by saying that King Shlomo made these golden objects. That doesn't mean he made them personally. It just means that he oversaw the project, that it was his administration that provided them. The purpose was to explain that these objects weren't added later by other kings of Israel. Bottom line was, the idea was to give Solomon all the credit. Among the objects of gold that were made was the menorah, or better, the menorot, plural, because Shlomo, we're told, had 10 of them made instead of the original 1 menorah. Verse 48 speaks of 2 other temple furnishings made of gold, the incense altar and the table where the loaves of showbread were stacked. In addition, there were various tongs and plates and bowls and pitchers, all that kind of stuff. And the chapter ends with Solomon giving the large amounts of expensive objects that his father David had collected for either use in the temple or for financing its construction. However, for some reason, Solomon decided not to use them for temple service and instead just stored them in the temple treasury, put them in the vault. The Hebrew scholar Abarbanel suggests that the reason for this decision was pretty straightforward. It was due to the prophetic message that had been given to King David through Nathan the prophet. And the message was that David was not to be engaged in building the temple. That David went ahead and drew up plans, and he started collecting timber from Lebanon and having implements for the temple design and manufactured, and all of that was not a legitimate thing for him to have done. it may have followed the letter of God's oracle to David, not to build the temple, but it didn't follow the spirit of it. David wasn't to have anything to do with the temple. That was reserved for God and for Shlomo. David, being that headstrong person that he was, thought he had a loophole. He'd just go ahead and make all the preparations and all the plans for the temple. He just wouldn't actually construct it. He'd just control it from the grave. Now, doesn't that sound an awful lot like us sometimes? It's clear from the words of the Holy Scriptures or from godly wisdom given to us by someone that there is something we must not do. But immediately we start searching for a loophole. And it brings us right up to the edge so that we can get most of what we want. But then we can say, technically, we were obedient to God. I don't think God buys that kind of convoluted rationale from us any more than he did from David. Well, now that the temple and its furnishings have been completed, and we have a pretty good idea of what it all looked like, let's go on a journey. Let's go on a journey to see what happened to this temple from its birth to its demise. We know that the Lord told Moses while he was on the Exodus journey that in time, there was to be but one authorized place for worship and for sacrifice for all Israel. That instruction is recorded for us, beginning in Deuteronomy 12:5. There we read, "Rather, you are to come to the place where Adonai your God will put his name. He'll choose it from all your tribes. You will seek out that place, which is where he will live, and you will go there. You will bring there your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tenths that you set aside for Adonai, the offerings that you give, the offerings you have vowed, your voluntary offerings, and the firstborn of your cattle and your sheep. There you will eat in the presence of Adonai your God, and you will rejoice over everything you set out to do, you and your households, in which Adonai your God has blessed you. You will not do things the way we do them here today, where everyone does whatever in his own opinion seems right, because you haven't yet arrived at the rest and at the inheritance which Adonai your God is giving to you." However, Israel was anything but quick to obey. They responded by building high places, bamot, as personal and private family worship centers. The various tribal coalitions didn't all recognize the traditional site where the remnants of the wilderness tabernacle was erected as that single authorized place of worship. The evidence is that there was a temple in operation in Jerusalem almost continuously from the time Solomon built and completed it around 960 BC until 586 BC when the Babylonians razed it. But there were changes, there were modifications to it, as well as allowing it to deteriorate or at other times to be stripped of its valuable materials over that nearly four century time span. Shortly after Shlomo died, the kingdom of Israel fell into a civil war and it divided. The united kingdom of all 12 tribes that developed and thrived under David and Solomon split along long-held traditional tribal lines that can be identified and followed since the days of the Exodus. There had been separate northern tribal coalitions, northern and southern tribal coalitions, since the days of Joshua. And that is more or less the same way the nation divided itself after Solomon. Thus, following Solomon, there were now two kings over two kingdoms, Rehoboam, king of Judah, Jeroboam, king of Israel. Now, I want to take one moment to explain something. I've addressed it before, but it's so very important to our understanding of the remainder of the Bible and even of the prophetic happenings that are current and future to our modern time. What we read in the next several chapters and books of the Old Testament is of two kingdoms, one called Judah, one called Israel. But in reality, the one called Israel was only a coalition of a group of 10 tribes, usually identified as the Northern Coalition. It only used the name Israel for a handful of decades after that civil war that split Solomon's former United Kingdom. Rather, that 10-tribe Northern Coalition was dominated by the tribe of Ephraim. So that kingdom was named after him, and it was called Ephraim. So within 30 to 50 years after Solomon's death in 925 BC, there was the kingdom of Judah, down to the south, the kingdom of Ephraim, also known as the kingdom of Israel or even the kingdom of Ephraim Israel. All three mean the same place. Well, in the fifth year of Rehoboam's reign, remember he was the king of Judah, a fellow named Shishak, the pharaoh of Egypt, attacked, and he plundered the temple in Jerusalem. The Egyptians took much of that precious gold and of the gold and silver implements and the furnishings and the items that were stored in the temple and in its warehouses. Now, one can easily imagine that from Shishak's perspective, this wasn't looting. This was restitution for all that gold and silver that the Israelites received from the Egyptians and took with them when they exited Egypt under Moses. And by the way, the Egyptians still feel the same way today about this. This was the first major change here, Shishak and his looting of the temple. This was the first major change to Solomon's temple. Up in the north, the king of Israel, or Ephraim Israel, Jeroboam, ignored the temple in Jerusalem. And instead, he established two worship centers for his kingdom, one in Dan, up to the north, one in Bethel, for the people living in the south of his kingdom. Now, what went on in those places that purported to be the worship of the God of Israel was sickening. Calf worship was established in Dan, and all sorts of abominable cult practices were instituted. A separate priesthood was ordained. Now, I've taken a number of tour groups to Dan, and the syncretism that took place there becomes immediately obvious. Even the remains of a square horned altar, typical of the temple altar, is still visible there. But the people of the 10 northern tribes mixed the worship of animals and of Baal, and there's strong evidence of human sacrifice. Asa succeeded Rehoboam as the king of Judah, and so he ruled over Judah for about 40 years until 868 BC. And at the encouragement of his father, Ahijah, Asa tried to replenish the many gold and silver vessels that had been taken by Shishak. But in just a few years, he used those same expensive and valuable vessels to buy the mercenary services of a fellow named Ben-Hadad, who was the king of Syria, so that he could defend himself against Baasha, who was now the king of Israel. And the scriptures seem to indicate that Asa also used some of the temple items to finance matters of his administration for his own political benefit. Asa's son was a familiar name, Jehoshaphat. And he inherited the monarchy directly from his father, and he reigned over Judah for 20 years. Now, he seemed to be a king that the people liked, and they respected him. So there was valuable gifts given, many of you which were used to restore the looted ones from the temple. He was also a man who tried to bring a measure of godliness back to his people. So he sent some priests and Levites on a journey to the various clans of Judah to teach them the Torah. We're told that they took with them the law, which probably meant what we today call the Book of Deuteronomy. And I think this is most likely because we know that the Book of Deuteronomy was stored outside and alongside the Ark of the Covenant. So the high priest would have been too fearful to take the stones from inside the Ark of the Covenant. But apparently it didn't bother him too much to take that scroll that was laid next to it. Now Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went on to create an alliance with Ahav, king of Ephraim Israel, through the usual means. He married Ahav's daughter. Well, now these two kings battled alongside one another against a force from a place called Aram. And as a result of coming very close to being killed, a certain prophet informed Jehoshaphat that the Lord was not happy with him. So this seemed to spark another round of religious reforms in Judah. In addition, Ahav made some improvements to the temple by constructing yet another courtyard. Now, likely this was an expansion of the existing one that he deemed as just too small. And during his era, the hilltop of Mount Moriah was being modified and expanded, with the shallow valleys next to the hill being filled up with the soil of the low ridges that surrounded it, making the whole area level enough to add some more buildings and some defensive walls too. Anyway, after Jehoshaphat's death, the next several kings were really bad kings, and they did very evil things. Jehoram succeeded Jehoshaphat for a little over a decade. He was succeeded by Ahaziah, who barely lasted a year. Athaliah then took over. He managed to hang on to the throne for about 5 years. His sons were worthless men who robbed the temple of valuable treasures for personal gain and gave some of it even to the temple of Baal. It's not that the temple in Jerusalem ceased to operate, but one can only imagine the strain and the strangeness of what went on there in order to appease this wicked king and his radical sons. But Athaliah also had another son, a young one, named Joash. He reigned from 840 to about 800 BC, and during this time there was a high priest named Jehoiada that seems to have been quite strong, and he was given much authority to try and restore some sanctity to these temple operations, as well as to instill a proper piousness in the people of Judah. He even organized the Levites into guard units, and each unit was assigned to watch over the gate of the foundation. Now, apparently this was a new gate into the temple area that was essentially built as a means to restore the temple building, or maybe even keep it from collapse. After all, by now the original temple was 150 years old and had seen a lot of calamity, and it had been looted on many occasions. King Joash was truly a reformer, but it appears that the elderly high priest Jehoiada was his mentor and his guide. For several years, Joash collected funds from his fellow countrymen to restore the temple, and it seems that the northern kingdom of Ephraim probably even contributed to it as well. 2 Chronicles chapter 24 records this restoration project, and the words are that the project was completed. So apparently, the temple was fully restored. How close to the original is anybody's guess? But I can easily imagine that by now what the original is built by King Shlomo exactly looked like wasn't even known anymore. Unfortunately, the death of the high priest led to Joash backsliding and losing his direction. And once again, the temple fell into disrepair. Amaziah took over after Joash. But during his reign, the temple was looted again. However, this time it wasn't a foreign enemy doing the looting, but rather the new king of Ephraim Israel. By the way, this king's name was also Joash, but this was a different Joash. And he did it in retribution against Amaziah. Well, after him came his son Uzziah, and he takes us to the mid-700s BC. Now, for a while, Uzziah had a listening ear. to the wise and godly counsel of Zechariah, and so Judah regained some stature and influence in the region. Uzziah's successes seemed to go to his head, because for whatever reason, he decided he wanted to be the one to burn incense on the altar of incense inside the Hekal, the holy place inside of the temple. That was a definite no-no. This ritual, even entry into the holy place, was restricted by the Torah law to the priests. And as a result, Uzziah was cursed with Sarat. Most Bibles call this leprosy, but that's just not so. Sarat could mean any number of skin diseases, but the point was, this was a skin disease that was caused as a direct act of Yehovah to supernaturally, essentially, take the inner condition of a person as God sees them and have them wear it on their exterior, on their skin, exposed for everybody to see. And it was during the same era that the prophets Amos and Isaiah lived. And they both warned of a coming earthquake. It happened in the last year of Uzziah's reign, and the quake severely damaged not just the building of the temple, but seems to have actually disturbed the foundation. And by the way, Zechariah is the one who said that far into the future, there would be another earthquake so violent that the Mount of Olives would literally split and separate into two hills. This event is, of course, what the church generally says marks the return of the Lord, when his foot touches down on the Mount of Olives, and that sets off a devastating earthquake that even produces a new river that runs all the way from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea. And interestingly, by the way, such a thing is entirely geographically possible because the Dead Sea is nearly 4,000 feet lower in elevation than Jerusalem. And after Uzziah's time, it was Yotam's turn to rule Judah. And he oversaw many repairs to the now badly damaged temple. He also constructed the so-called Upper Gate, another new addition to the temple. And no doubt this had a lot to do with stabilizing the structure and the grounds that had been damaged. But Yotam's son, Ahaz, took over after he died in 742 BC, and Ahaz was, he was a demon on steroids. He so wrecked the holy temple that following him, a long and extensive refurbishment was required. Ahaz no sooner became king than, as noted in 2 Kings 16, he extracted all the wealth he could from that holy building and he gave it to Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria in order to woo him as an ally. Not only that, but when Ahaz went up to visit Tiglath-Pileser in Syria, he was so impressed with a certain altar to their god, he wanted one just like it for himself. The altar Solomon had built was now replaced with this new pagan-styled one. The original altar was unceremoniously shoved out of the way. But that was just the beginning. Ahaz defaced the molten sea by taking it down off the backs of those bronze oxen. He cut the legs off the rolling water lavers. He even rededicated part of the temple complex to the Assyrian god that he admired so much. He ordered the building of a large number of other altars to other gods all over the city of Jerusalem. The temple became so ruined, the priests were so enraged, that he responded by shuttering the temple doors and ending all temple rituals. But God was not yet done with his temple. Soon there was going to arise a king who would restore this dilapidated, this defiled place to glory. And we'll discuss that next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.